I have to say, it's absolutely delightful to be here. You know, for me, sort of speaking at an Adoption UK event, it's kind of like, it's coming back home, it's family. You know, I've been an adopter for just over 20 years now. And before my kids came, I went to Adoption UK meetings and I met with other adopters. And I think over the last 20 years, my biggest learnings have been from my kids. And my second biggest learnings have been from other adopters who have been the people who have been truthful when I needed truth and have held up a mirror and reflected things back to me that I needed to see, that I needed to understand. And on several occasions I said to people who, you know, are my mentors, I think this is a problem, what do you think? And they went, oh yeah. So I hope that I'm here partly as a bit of a reflection for you and an oh yeah. And to talk about growing up with social networking, and my frame here is around limiting the emotional shrapnel and why pre-framing, truth-telling, actually beats reframing. And when the first book, Facebook, first appeared and exploded on the scene, which was 2010, beginning of 2010. It didn't exist before then. My response to a question for a radio interview was that Facebook has the potential to blow adoption out of the water. I still think that is true. I also think it has the potential to transform adoption as we know it, if we are prepared to be truthful, if we are prepared to be honest, and if we are prepared to look at the real reasons that kids get adopted, which is about trauma and the impact of what happens to them before their legal status is changed. Let me also add as a pre-frame here, I think that what I'm going to say applies equally in fostering, in long-term fostering, as it does in adoption. Pre-framing. What is a pre-frame? A pre-frame is telling somebody something before it happens. So, as they do in hospitals, you know, you're going to have an injection, it's just a little scratch. So you know, before they stick the needle in you. But you know, you are aware of it. And let me pre-frame my session today in two ways. One is bad language is probable. Not because, you know, I have no other words, but sometimes they're done for dramatic effect. Those of us that live with traumatized children, if you can't cope with bad language, then, yeah. Let me just get a sense, and so that you can have a quick look around the room. How many of you here are adopters? So just have a look round, so that, you know, because part of things like this is about networking. How many perspectives?
Next week.
Next week. Okay. Stay calm. Social workers? Okay, so we have a mix in the room, which is great. Anybody else? Anybody a therapist? Splendid. Great having therapists. Medics? Anybody else like that? Okay, so my first pre-frame was around language. And my second pre-frame is I'm not sticking to the script because we have an opportunity. We have some space. And so we're going to use the space and we're going to do, with your permission, a little bit of playing later on. You up for that? Yeah? So pre-framing, I'm going to get you to do things. We're going to think about a number of things. Thinking about framing, a frame of reference. The frame that we refer to, that we use, and any meaning in any situation will depend on the frame of reference that we're actually coming from. And that's worth just holding in mind. What is the frame of reference for any situation? Because it will adjust the meaning that you make from the situation. Let me give you an example. On Saturday, I live in a block, and one of a block of flats, and my sort of neighbour said to me, "Oh, I've I've got a bit of a crisis. Can you help? Now, I went into, yep, crisis. Now, in my world, crisis involves police, ambulances, hospitals. It might involve, you know, fire and flood. But it's, you know, it's major crisis. When I pick up the phone and a friend of mine says, you know, an adopter says, I've got a problem, I know it's going to... Now, my neighbour had a crisis. She was saying, I really don't know what to do. I've got this recipe for sea bass. I kid you not. And I went, oh, okay. And then we stood for it. Should you take the skin off with this cream and tarragon recipe? And I'm standing thinking, wow. And then her husband came out and he said, I've got George on the phone, and George says that according to Marco Pierre White, you always... And I'm thinking, OMG. You know, my crisis is, she's been arrested, I can't get down there, will you go and act as... the responsible adult, please. Now, that to me is a crisis. So a sea bass, calibrating it on a scale of 1 to 10, it's a 1 or a 2. However, for these people, it was actually, you know, it was quite a big deal. So our frame of reference is quite interesting, and it is one of the benefits of being an adopter. And I learned this from my great friend and mentor, Linda Gilbert, which is that kind of once you've been through 20-odd years of adoptive parenting, there ain't nothing going to throw you. Ain't nothing. You know, your car gets wrecked or whatever. So bear that in mind, in that some of the stuff you're going to hear today is challenging, some of the stuff is difficult. I think I will rattle your cage. I suspect Lewis might. Because we have to do that to actually get to where we want to be. Lewis might actually just be incredibly nice to you. I just may not. And my frame today is actually to look at all three corners of the adoption triangle. And I just drew this just quickly. And the three corners of the adoption triangle, the child. And traditionally we look at the child, the birth parent, the adoptive parent. I thought, that's really interesting. And I just stood here and I drew, well, birth parent, there's a mum and a dad, and then there's all these other people, the siblings, the aunts, the uncles, the friends. Adoptive parent, you got mum and dad, you may have some others, and you may have some siblings, but it tend to be a lot smaller. And then there is the category of siblings, which doesn't fit neatly into the adoption triangle, but is actually very relevant when it comes to Facebook, because we are certainly finding that siblings are connecting with each other. So you may have an older couple of children who stayed with birth parents or went into foster care later on, who were the carers for a couple of kids left at home. Do they want to know what happened to them? Of course they do. Of course. And that's going to make the dynamics immediately start being quite difficult. So if you just look at this nice simple triangle, suddenly you get all sorts of things that could be sticking out from the side. So this again is why we have to start really reframing and thinking very differently about the adoption model that we have. My presentation is much more today about whys. Why are people behaving in the way that they are? What are they doing? What's their motivation for it? Lewis later on this afternoon is going to give you more on the tools side. So I'm going to restrict myself more into the whys. And the whys about what you need to know to actually think about truth telling. And let me start from the adopter's perspective. Now, I am an adopter. I adopted a sibling group, three kids, 20 years ago. And I've been involved with Adoption UK. I was a local coordinator for 10 years. I was a trustee for 6 years. You know, I've hung out in this world. I was a member of the government task force way back when, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago. I've done therapy with my kids at Family Futures. I've done the 2-year attachment and adoption course, which is how I know Lewis and all sorts of other people. So, you know, I've got quite a lot of cred and quite a lot of knowledge in this area. And I've stood up on platforms over the years, a huge amount. However, My world was rocked when my kids got an email from their birth mum. Absolutely threw me personally completely off kilter. And it took me a number of months to integrate, relate, process, deal with what was going on. And I share that with you because I've yet to find an adopter who's not been really thrown by it. Now, bearing in mind that for me and the friends of mine who are dealing with this, we have children in maybe late teens, early 20s, mid-teens going on. So we've had our children quite a long time. Some of us may have had a little bit of contact. We may have had some letterbox contact, bits and pieces. Most of the people that I know in the adoption world are like me. We read, we go to training courses, we learn, we do masses of work with our kids. However, for all of us, it's been pretty devastating. And I say that because I think it's important that everyone needs to know that when it does happen, you are going to be rocked. Because it does touch old stuff that you thought you dealt with, old stuff that you didn't even know was there. And that element of how are they going to feel about me when they've been contacted by birth mum or birth dad. And my experience is that both sides of the adoption triangle are searching in that. You know, kids are looking and birth parents are looking. I've yet to find any major common threads. But it was the devastation that was wreaked that I noticed that then, you know, I wrote a couple of articles in the Adoption UK magazine, and then people started contacting me and saying, guess what's happened to me? So the stories have continued, and many of them have been slow motion car crashes. And I know of a number of people whose children have returned to their birth families, and they have returned sometimes with staying, having a bit of connection with adopters, and sometimes they have broken connections with their adoptive parents. Will that last long term? We don't know. It's far too early to say. If you've got kids who are in their late teens, early 20s, this is naturally a time they're going to move away from their family. The question that we don't have, and we'll have in 10 years' time, is whether they come back. So a lot of this is work in progress. And there is no route map. And that was one of the reasons that I wrote Bubble Wrap Children, because there was no route map. And because it was confusing, difficult, and for many of us, it was incredibly distressing. So, I've got these quotes up here. Life is not what it's supposed to be, it's what it is. The way you cope with it is what makes the difference. And that's Virginia Satir. And this quote that I think is really useful for adoptive parenting in terms of getting some perspective and saying, when you find yourself stressed, ask yourself one question. Will this matter 5 years from now? And if yes, then do something about the situation. If no, then let it go. I would suggest to you that actually most of the questions that relate to our kids, to adopted and foster children, are things that will continue to be significant 5 years down the line. And burying your head in the sand and playing ostrich is not a good long-term strategy. And the reason it's not a good long-term strategy is for this reason. Reasons children were removed from their birth parents. Now, I probably don't need to remind you as an audience, but I am. These are children who were removed from their birth families by social services, endorsed by the courts because their birth families failed to look after them and exposed them to considerable harm. So we have emotional abuse. We have emotional abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, and neglect. Now those are, you know, categories that governments talk about. I've thrown a couple of others in. A chaotic environment and trauma itself. And I'm going to touch on trauma in a moment. But let's just remember, this is what our children have experienced. This is what they came from. Plus the 9 months that they had in the womb before they came. So this is their legacy. And if you just just for a moment stop and think, well, what are the ramifications? And that's, you know, let's take neglect. Unfed for days, nappies are not changed, there are no toys, there's no interactions with adults, they're left alone for hours, unwashed with no play. What does that do to them? So this third category, what it did to them. So there was what was done to them and then what it did to them. So they end up with what kind of beliefs? Maybe that they don't matter, that they're not significant. Do they even exist? And there's that lovely Greg Keck quote, which is, if you have to choose between abuse and neglect, choose abuse. It does less damage. Which may seem counterintuitive until you step back and think, if you're being abused, somebody notices you and knows that you are there. If you are being neglected, do you even exist? And I frame that because it's one of the things that courts find so difficult, because they want to have evidence. How do you evidence neglect? So what did it do to them? And what it did to them, I think, falls under the category of trauma. And in this context, trauma is defined in one of two ways. Either an overwhelming emotion that you're unable to integrate, or a belief that you might die. And very briefly, I'm going to touch on post-traumatic stress disorder, the adult version of trauma. And then there is complex trauma or developmental trauma disorder. And I have a metaphor, which is that I think with post-traumatic stress disorder, it's like a car that's been involved in a car crash. And that's what happens. With children, it's different, because with children, the trauma is occurring while they are being created. So it's as if they are going through the manufacturing of the car. So the car is being constructed, so maybe the chassis gets laid out. And instead of it being absolutely square, and everything that should be at 90 degrees, it's 90 degrees, it's not. To 88 degrees. So just a little bit off. Not really noticeable to the naked eye. And then other bits get put on, and it may be that one of the pistons should be 3 centimetres long, and it isn't. It's 2.5 centimetres long. And the exhaust, actually, instead of going down and out, all the way out to the back, actually there's a hole in it which just allows fumes to go up through where the gear stick is and actually fill the passenger compartment. The screws that the tyre nuts are put on one of the wheels, the screws, they just haven't been put in quite tightly enough. They're not quite there. So when this car travels along at 20 miles an hour, you can't really notice it. Put it on a long journey on a motorway, i.e. under stress, and the fumes start filling up the compartment. And that could be the time that, bang, off comes the wheel. Does that make sense? So the developmental trauma side of it, the impact of early trauma, is one of the key things that we have to bear in mind when we are thinking about Facebook. It's part of the bigger picture. And you have to keep the big picture to actually help work out what kids need and what you need to support them. And so what I'm going to do is we're going to step into the shoes of the child. You have this slide, and you will see there is a slide after it, that one. And if you look in your notes, you will see that slide which says sensory experience gingerbread man metaphor. You're going to remember this much more when you draw it for yourself. So I'm going to leave that one up on the screen, and I'm going to use the flip chart. And one of the reasons that I do this on a flip chart is partly to kind of empower you, because as you will see, I am not the most artistic, best drawer in the world. But does that represent a person? Yeah. So I want to just have a scenario for Tim. And Tim is an infant lying in a cot. And Tim is lying there, and it's dark, so there's nothing that he can see. It's November, and he's got a very thin t-shirt, and he's got a nappy that's not been changed for 12 hours or so. So there is a pretty awful smell. So he can smell the urine and he can smell the cell feces. And actually, he can put his hand down and on his fingers, he can feel the contents of the nappy and he can feel his nappy rash. That cracked, bumpy feel. So he has those as sensory experiences. He also has cold feet. His feet are very cold. Actually, most of them is pretty cold. So he has that feeling of cold feet. And he's also hungry. He's not actually been fed for quite some time. And he has a pain in his tummy. So he's got these sensory experiences happening to him. And in his mouth, well, he's got the taste of sour milk. Because he had some milk earlier and then he was sick. So he's got the taste of sour milk and vomit. And the smell of sour milk as well. Can you see how these sensory triggers would be linked to lying in a cot with neglect? Does that make sense? Now, those sensory triggers, they are stored. Trauma is stored in the body. And I think that for each of these kind of episodes, it's as if he is getting, he's kind of being, that's where the emotional shrapnel and the sensory shrapnel occurs. And there's never just one event. Often there's more than one event. We have another way of thinking about... This one looks even more... This looks more like ET, but there we go. You get the picture. There will be lots and lots of different incidences like this. And I think metaphorically what happens is that kids store this. So they might store episodes. Maybe bits of cold or particular things. And they get stored, and let's say metaphorically, like pieces of blue glass get stored in the body. And then there may be another set of incidences. For example, every time his birth dad shouts in his face, says, "Shut up, you little bastard." Every time that happens, you have little bits of red rock that gets stored in the body. And then every time that his dad shouts at his mum or hits his mum, gets stored as a bit of green string and gets stored in the body. Does this make sense? See how the picture builds up over time? So metaphorically, those things are happening repeatedly and they are being stored in the body. And then we have to think, well, what happens to them? Every time that he's hungry, every time food doesn't appear, what's the impact of that? And it's stored as trauma. And trauma is not stored with language, it's not stored with logic, it can't be thought about, it's not controllable. It's base brain stuff. You're not in control of it, therefore pretty significant. And to quote Maya Angelou, we learn that people will forget what you said, people will forget what you did, but people will never forget how you made them feel. And that's significant, because if there were people involved every time that green bit of string was linked to, let's say, birth father, what's going to happen when birth father appears in front of Tim a few years down the line? What sensory triggers are going to be connected for him? And these memories are going to be quite unconscious. Make sense? Okay, so we have Tim, two versions of Tim. One thing that I missed from here, which is auditory. What does he hear? So what does he hear, see, smell, feel, taste, touch? And these are the triggers. So, are you up for doing a little bit of playing? What I would like you to do is I'd like you just to leave all your stuff here and I want you to congregate at the back of the room. Good grief, you're saying to yourself, I've come to a conference and she's making me move around. Well, I'd like you in line, ideally kind of across here. I'm going to ask you to be Tim And you are going to step forward as if you're going down a timeline. So you're all going to move forward a pace or two at a time, and I'm just going to talk you through Tim's life. So you're all facing the far wall, and I just want you to imagine, just for a moment, and I'm not going to ask you to stay there, that you are Tim in that cot, and you've had those experiences. And now I want you to step forward one pace, so that you're a year or so down the line. So step forward. And you're in a nice, clean, sparkly foster home. And now step forward again, and you're now step forward, and you're a couple of years in, and you're five, and you're with your new adopters, and you're at school. So you're in primary school. And just think, what are you likely to be doing? What are you doing in primary school? You're all terribly well behaved at the moment. And now step forward another pace, and you're about seven, and you're just at that stage of maybe moving from infants to juniors. You know, what games you're going to be playing in the playground, what you're going to be doing at home. And now step forward another pace, and you're about nine, and you're doing various activities at school. Just think what you're doing with all those beliefs that you've got and this new adoptive placement. And now step forward another pace, and you're 11, and it's your SATs year, and you've been doing sex education at school. And in school they asked you to bring in photographs, the family, photographs of yourself as a baby maybe. And just notice how that is. And now I want you to step forward a quarter of a pace, because you're just starting secondary school. And you're just starting at secondary school, and you're the young, you know, you're one of the youngest in the school. Everybody else is bigger than you now. In the last school, everybody, you were bigger than everybody else. How's that feeling? Oof, and you're noticing strange things in your body. And step forward another pace. Ooh, and now an alien's taken over your body. Those hormones are flying. And parts of your brain are going offline. You're a teenager. 15% of your brain goes offline. And now step forward another pace. You're about 15. And just think, you know, what's life like for you? And now step forward another quarter pace. And it's spring, just before you do your GCSEs, and you've done some coursework. And you're in your bedroom, and you're on Facebook. And you get an email that says, "Hi, remember me? I'm your birth mum. You've been told lies about me." What do you do? And now step forward and a quarter pace again. And it's the night before your maths GCSE. And you receive another email on Facebook. And it's from your older brother, George, who's 20. It says, "I really miss you." How are you doing? Want to hook up? And now take another pace forward. And it's just before your 18th birthday. And just notice where you are, who you're with, and what you're doing. Okay, now I want you to shake that off, move away from that spot. Shake it all off, turn around, jump, and tell the person next to you what you had for breakfast. What did you have for breakfast? And you can now come and sit back down. And for those of you that are terribly anxious about the process and the significance of breakfast, it's a state change. I wanted you to change your state from that experience. And you've just had an experience. So, let's just think for a moment about what was the motivation of the birth mother who sent that email that said, "Hi, remember me, you've been told lies about me. And that's a real email. You think about the birth parent perspective. If they've had no updates and no fresh understanding, what are they going to be thinking? Is he alive? Is he dead? Does he hate me? Does he love me? I want them. They are mine. And one of the things that happens is this sense of ownership, often, that birth parents can have about their children. He's mine. She's mine. And the genuine feeling, I want them back. He's all grown up now. And think of how many birth parents have been told, well, once they're 18, you can, you know, maybe get back in contact with them when they're an adult. What expectations have been set up? And let's just think for a moment about this particular scenario here with Tim. Tim's lying in a cot. Mum and Dad were fighting downstairs, possibly drunk. How much of that do you think birth mum's going to remember? How much of that is Dad going to remember? Now, that was actually maybe the night that the police came along, and the fight and the noise that Tim can hear, the crashing, was actually the police getting that big thing that goes bang and knocks the door off. And the police come in and it's mayhem. There's chairs being thrown, there's screaming and shouting. Maybe it's a drugs bust, who knows? But there's a huge amount of noise. There's a huge amount of activity. Tim's experience and the experience of the adults at the same time are going to be very different. And it's worth remembering that from the birth parent perspective. And the birth parents are still screaming. The birth parents have had children adopted, long-term fostered, removed from them. They have been torn away from them. They have been ripped away. Birth parents didn't consent. They didn't want it to happen. They are stuck, I think, in a grief process because they have no way of getting out of it. And they have, I think, a mindset, and we have to understand their mindset. Because if we can understand their mindset, it's going to help us understand what might happen in the future. Birth parents love their children. Whatever damage they did to them, whatever harm they did to them, they love their children. In the same way that a man who beats his partner loves her, in a way that many of us in the room might not agree with and think it's a very strange way to evidence love. You know, love for me wouldn't actually involve a clip round the head and don't talk to him because you're mine. Ooh, is that my evidence of love? I mean, personally, I mean, you know, I'm into flowers, chocolates, you know, having a meal cooked for me, those sorts of things. That would be the evidence that I would want to see as evidence that somebody loved me. But, you know, different people, different evidence. But for birth parents, they do love their children. And they always will. I think one of the other things that happens while birth parents are being assessed with their children, because these things don't, you know, kids hang around in toxic environments for a long time, the calibration and the rule of optimism. Social workers will help parents and keep saying, oh yes, you've done that a bit better, or that's a bit better, and that's a little bit better. Now that little bit better, on a scale of 1 to 100, what they wanted to see was a 50, and the little bit better was moving from 2 to 3, or maybe from 3 to 5, but was so far off what was needed in terms of what was required for a child. But for the birth parents, they're saying, well, yes, I'm, you know, social worker says I'm doing this better, because we think that praising them will be good. Whereas we're not actually setting clear boundaries and clear expectations about what was required. So a few years later, the birth parents saying, well, I don't really know what I did wrong. They said I needed to tidy up the house. Well, I did tidy up the house. The fact that in our eyes, tidying up the house would have included taking out all the black bags, taking out all the rubbish, clearing the dog shit off the floor, not having the pizza boxes all over the floor, and actually having a mattress with a sheet to sleep on for the child, that's what we would have expected. The birth parents said, but, you know, well, I got her a coat. Yeah, you got her a coat. However, you didn't do a whole load of other things. So I think from the birth parent perspective, they are left with confusion. as to why their kids got taken away. One of the other things I think, and it's in Bubble Wrap Children in more detail, is about empathy. Empathy is about standing in somebody else's shoes, which is what I just asked you to do in that exercise. And many of you found it difficult and quite distressing because you've got empathy. You can see something from somebody else's perspective. Many of these birth parents don't have empathy. They don't have mindsight, same sort of principle. They don't have the ability to do that because of their own very difficult history themselves. Often they've been promised some kind of contact, you'll get a letter or you can see them later on. And often it's done with good intentions or possibly to placate, to make things easier at the time, but it is setting up false expectations. And I think one of the questions we have to ask for birth parents is, what has changed? What has changed for them, and what support do they have now, and what support do they need in the future? Because from their perspective, that night when Tim was ripped from them, when the police came and knocked the door down, blue flashing lights, they actually may have absolutely no memory of that whatsoever. If your primary need is alcohol or drugs, it's only when that's satisfied are you going to think about the kids. And it may be they have no memory, so they're going to deny it a bit further down the line when there's a reconnection. So there may be a complete mismatch. And you see on this slide, there's that, we've got the infant perspective of Tim lying in a cot. And then there's the photograph of a child blowing out candles with mummy on a cake. I've yet to find a life story, but it hasn't got one of those in them. And what child doesn't blow out candles on a cake with birth mum? However, there isn't the other side of it. There isn't the photographs of the rubbish bags and the dog shit and the mattress on the floor. As a friend of mine and the kids said, we used to play with the sugar on the mattress. Mum said, you used to do what? We used to play with the sugar on the mattress. After a while, they realised that what they were playing with was crystallised urine. And that's what the kids were playing with. And these were children, lovely photographs of birth mum blowing out the candles. There is a massive mismatch for birth parents, for children, about what goes on. A life storybook does not tell the story of a life. We don't see the photographs of the squalor. Children get told, sometimes your mum got angry so she couldn't look after you. Well, what parents don't get angry? And so a kid is left with, all kids get angry, so what was that? And it might be, my birth parents couldn't look after me, so there was something wrong with me. Reframe that one into, your parents couldn't look after any child. Big difference in language. They couldn't look after any child. It wasn't you. They couldn't look after any child. And actually, you look at many birth parents, they can't look after a dog or a cat. I mean, I'm absolutely serious. You look at the photographs and there's a different dog in all the pictures. And it's that framing. And I think we need to take photographs of professionals, should be taking photographs, and police. And sometimes they do, but they don't get through to the kids and they don't get into the life storybook. We don't take photographs at funerals. Why not? It's just a bigger part as a christening or a marriage. And does it tell the full story? I think we could think about that. And in that line, I think what we need to do is we need to tell the truth. The reason I have metaphors, they work with kids. They draw a picture, they conjure a picture in your mind. It makes it easier to understand. And that's part of the reason that I use them. I think that children need 100% truth-telling. They need to know the grim stuff. They need to know the ugly stuff. And they need to know it in an age-appropriate way. I have the jigsaw of truth. If you were going to buy a jigsaw for a 5-year-old, you might buy a 9-piece jigsaw. And you might have a scene with some sky, and there's some sand, and there is a boat, and that's the big picture. So that's it. It is a coastal scene. Now, when that child gets a little older and they're 8, you might say, all right, well, we'll make a 25 or a 30-piece jigsaw puzzle or a... We'll just make slightly more pieces in the jigsaw, each with a bit more detail. Make sense? And then by the time you get to 11, you might give them a 350 piece jigsaw puzzle, and by the time they're 18, you may give them a 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle. You can do the same with information, so that when they're 5, you can say in this big thing here, Uncle Fred was very naughty. When you get to 8, you might say, Uncle Fred was very naughty. Sometimes he was very nice to children, and sometimes he was very bad and hurt children. So you develop that, and let's say by the age of, 12, you may say, Uncle Fred was a paedophile. And then maybe age appropriate, 16, 17, 18, when you're getting into the 1,000-piece jigsaw puzzle, you can tell a child that actually Uncle Fred was a paedophile. He's an unconvicted paedophile, but it is suspected that he is part of an international ring, and it's also suspected that there is video footage out there of your brothers being abused. Can you see how that is step by step by step? Giving you another metaphor for information, it's like going down a flight of stairs. If you're going down a flight of stairs, and you know, you may be slightly wobbly or the stairs might be a bit, you want to hold on to the rail with one hand and maybe have somebody else on the other side, and you're going to go down one step at a time, one step at a time, so that when you get to the bottom, you're intact, you've got there. The problem we have with contact via Facebook without any of the pre-framing is that you're going from the top of the stairs all in one, you're going down that flight of stairs all in one go, and bang, you hit the ground. It is literally a bloody mess at the bottom. Which is why I believe truth-telling, age-appropriately, going down over the years is absolutely essential. So this jigsaw of truth that we have here, if we link that to the sensory triggers, can you see how these might link? So that if a child knows that he was neglected, there may be some sensory triggers that fit together, and it will start making sense of that kind of nonsense. For the child that doesn't have information, then the triggers will still be there, but they won't be understood. In the same way that that timeline, that first timeline that you did, when you got that email from birth mum, it had an effect. So the triggers might be there, but they're not understood. And we know that the body keeps score. I want just to talk about different perspectives, and this is where the pre-framing and reframing comes in. If we imagine that today we had video cameras running in the corner of this room, up in every corner, we would have a different perspective from each of them. Now, we've all been at the same event today, yes?
Nah. No, we haven't.
No, we haven't. Because you have been listening, and you will listen to all the speakers, and you will have a different experience from the person sitting next to you. Because you're going to be running it through your own filters, through your own eyes, through your own thoughts. And there'll be times that you disappear off out of this room and your mind wanders off and you think, and you come back in the room and think, oh, what happened there? Now, you may have missed me or somebody else speaking, but what you've just done is had a learning. Because you've disappeared off and you've learnt something new, you've connected with something old, and you've come back in. So we've all had a very different experience here today. And understanding that starts helping us understand how and why reframing can work. If we can help kids understand what was going on for other people, we can understand it for ourselves. We could maybe look at that situation for Tim. What was the birth parent perspective? What was going on for them at the time? Now, if Tim gets a sense that actually it was a drugs bust and actually his birth parents were resisting arrest and the blue flashing light was actually not to do with him, it was something else, then it's different. If he can be helped with drama therapy, with reenacting things on a screen, be music therapy, sand trays, acting, blah, 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 various methodologies, then he's going to get some help understanding that situation. And kids, you could say to them, okay, just imagine there was a film crew there. Just imagine that there's all these policemen and all these police cars, and, you know, there's the news reporter there who's filming it. And you know how you see it on the news on the TV? Well, just imagine what that looked like from the outside. And with that sort of thing, we can have an empowering reframing. We can actually help kids have a different perspective, get a fresh knowledge, see things from different perspectives, and have age-appropriate wisdom by linking these sorts of things together, appropriate truth-telling with a jigsaw of truth, so that they actually can learn what happened to them and can learn to see how things were different. So this is a quote: an ounce of pre-frame is worth a pound of reframe. So going back to that, about to have an injection, it's going to be a little scratch. Yep, you knew it was coming. I've pre-framed, it's going to rattle your cage slightly, might make you slightly uncomfortable. I'm going to get you to walk around. By doing that, we can actually get to the point when kids can say, ah, so now I understand. Now I understand that this situation where the police came along, I was neglected and lying in a cot. Actually, the police came and they rescued me. Oh, that's different. And so that it could be that Tim can reframe the whole event into, that was one sad event that changed my life. That was the day I was rescued. And I was so important that people came along and took me out of that situation that was dangerous. So the sort of beliefs that might get changed from the lying in the cot, suffering, and thinking I don't exist, I don't matter, I'm not important, thinking back to the chart you had earlier on, those beliefs can be changed into, I am important. Do you know what? There was awful stuff in the past, but I'm important and the future looks good. And one of the things that that will do is it will help remove some of these pieces of shrapnel. That's what good therapeutic work will do. So whether they're the green bits of string, or the red pieces of rock, or the blue pieces of glass, or the chunks of mud, or the little bits of grass, whatever metaphorically these are, the emotional shrapnel that's there, therapeutic work is going to take some of them out. But it's going to take some of them out some of the time. So one piece of therapeutic work is not going to clear all this. So that's why it is an ongoing interventions, ongoing therapeutic work, ongoing work to help clear this shrapnel. And it answers the question that adopters often ask, and foster carers, and, you know, it's like, we've done so much work with these kids, why haven't they, you know, why hasn't it all cleared? It's because there's so much of it, and different things will work at different times and in different ways. Make sense? We're now going to do our second timeline. So you know what to do. We're going to start from the same place. You're Tim, and you've been laying in your cot. And now take one step forward into foster home. And now another small step into the adoptive placement. And another small step, and you're 5 years old, starting school. And now you can take another pace forward. You're about seven. And you know, and just, you may just want to close your eyes and just tune into this. Because you know that sometimes you have to be careful, because there are some people like Uncle Fred who are out there who may seem nice, but actually might be quite naughty. And now take another step forward. You're about nine, and somebody approaches you with some sweets. It's somebody you don't know. And now step forward another pace, and you're about 11, and it's sex education at school, and you've been asked to bring in a photograph of yourself. What do you do? What do you think? What do you feel? What do you see? And now take another step forward, and you're 13, and the hormones are starting to surge around. And you got a computer, and you got Facebook. What do you do? What do you notice? And now step forward another step. And you're about 15. And you get an email from Uncle Fred. What do you do? How do you feel? And now take another step forward. And you're 16. Just about to do your GCSEs. And you have an email from your birth mum that says, "Hi, remember me? You've been told lies about me. What do you see? What do you hear? What do you feel?" And now step forward and you're 18. And you're just about to have your 18th birthday. What do you notice? And now turn round and look at the place, just as you are. Turn through 180 degrees and just look at where that younger Tim was. And look back down the timeline. What's the learning? What are the learnings? What do you notice? Okay, and now I want you to move from where you are to anywhere else in the room. Just move and slightly shake off what you did and think, "I wonder what's for lunch." And move to a position where you can see the line that you just walked down, because I want you to have a look at it through your own eyes. So if you're an adoptive parent, if you're a social worker, look at that line of that child and think, with the learning that I've just got, what would I as a parent do differently now? What do I need to do? What do I need to think about? Look at that line. What's the learning? And now think about the jigsaw of truth. How does that fit into the line? And think, what can you do to empower that child? What can you do to help that child? And what do you need to do that challenging and difficult task? What resources do you need inside you? What else do you need to learn? What other skills do you need? What other support? And reflect on that. And know that this is a place that you can come back to again and again and again. And this is a place of empowerment, a place of reality, and a place to recognize what an amazing job you are doing. This is the toughest job in the world. And right now, ground yourself, just allow tree roots to grow down from your feet, and imagine that there is a huge magnet underneath you, and let anything, any energy that's not yours, any resistance, just shoof out and just go straight down into that magnet, and that magnet just drops down into the center of the earth. And now form another magnet 20 feet or so below. Anything that's not yours, just release it, release it, release it. Let it go, let it go, let it go. And now drop that magnet into the center of the earth. And now, above your head, allow a big gold cloud of energy to form. And allow that gold energy to come into your body and in the energy field around your body. In the body and the field outside the body. So that every cell is vibrating just perfectly. And know that you can do this anytime. You have all the resources that you need inside you, and you know where to go. So hold on to those and take them back to your seats and come and sit back down. Okay, I'm going to finish this quote, which is my quote. "It takes a village to raise a child, a town to raise a challenging child, and an entire city to raise a traumatized child." That's my belief. And in Bubble Wrap Children, I've made 8 recommendations, and I'm just going to read them out because I think it covers a lot of what we've done today. And let me say that these recommendations relate to Facebook and social networking. Do I have other recommendations for adoption? You bet. 8 recommendations. The first one is independent counselling for birth parents. I think to actually expect birth parents to have some kind of facilitated contact, which is managed, where every corner of the triangle knows what to expect. I think asking birth parents to do that without massive support is utterly unrealistic and grossly unfair. I also think it needs to be done not by social services. Not because social services and social workers couldn't do it, but they are tainted because, excuse me, in inverted commas, you're the bastards that took my kids away. They're contaminated. It has to be done separately. And it can be done by therapists, it can be done by... It's the sort of thing coaching would be really good because it's about helping people shift from one place to another. I think cameras and photographs should be used by the police and social workers and recorded. One photograph worth 1,000 words. Seeing the photograph of the kitchen or the bedroom that you were in changes it from being, it was a bit of a mess, to OMG, this is disgusting. And it is then also neutral. If a child can see the photograph, it's not filtered through somebody else's eyes. And often people want to make it slightly better for the child. That doesn't serve them. They've got the knowledge in the body. They know it in the muscle. And photographs and disclosure work, all of those things, confirm the evidence they already have. It makes sense of nonsense. Speed up the entire adoption process. Damage limitation. Well, duh. Improve adopter preparation and provide high quality ongoing training. I take a very hard line on adopter preparation. I think it needs to be really, 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 really robust and solid because we are asking adopters to do an enormous amount. And I also think when you bear in mind the timeline, adopters need things, different things at different time. And we need to provide ongoing, in-depth training throughout the child's childhood, adolescence, and certainly the early adulthood, because the problems don't stop there, as we are absolutely seeing with Facebook and Reconnection Now. Therapeutic reparenting. We need to do that for the children, and adopters must be supported in doing the therapeutic reparenting. We need to educate therapists in trauma, trauma-triggered behaviour, and a range of healing processes. Until we clear the trauma, these kids are going to get re-traumatised again and again and again and again and again. And Facebook is just one of the things. We need to deal with the underlying root cause, which is trauma, not the presenting symptoms. We have to make provision for facilitated contact. We have to support birth parents and members of the birth family. Because, you know, we've already discussed the siblings, various other people could be involved. We also need to support the adoptive family and we need to support the child. And long term, cost effectively, it's a no-brainer. And finally, I invite Facebook to acknowledge the situation and offer significant funding for healing. Now, I think they should. Trying to communicate with them, they only seem to want to talk through lawyers, which is really sad because I think they have a corporate social responsibility here. I really do. And they need to take some responsibility, although it is not their fault. You know, we cannot hold Facebook responsible for the curiosity and the completely understandable curiosity from birth parents and children. I think Facebook would do themselves a huge amount of good PR to really put some serious money into this. Bubble wrap children. You can download 3 chapters absolutely for free. And I've done that so that anyone can read it. I want this out there. I think we really, really, really need the public to understand. And I know that what other people have done is they've given the information to things like teachers. Because it's not just about Facebook. It is, as you can see, about the why, the trauma, the underlying stuff. So that other people in this arena understand the challenges that we as adoptive parents have and the challenges that our hurt children have. Thank you.